And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today we explore the very old and the very new as we go deep into caves and visit the tropical rainforest that is growing up in Iowa. Global warming? No. A grand new enclosed living biome known as Earth Park. When your voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Wild Side News is getting ready to celebrate its third anniversary on the air. And it's been an amazing time to be in the middle of the effort to bring our culture to a recognition that we're entering the age of consequences. We are now paying the price for our actions on a global basis. We have an amazing journey ahead of us. Years ago, I think it was Marshall McLuhan who launched the concept that we are all in this together, which he conventionalized as Spaceship Earth. Well, I think we just may need to ground ourselves more to our real circumstances, and I see it better now stated as our Earth boat. It's not the first time such a concept was floated. The story of Noah and his ark deserves a redwelling in our consciousness. The seas of change are surrounding us, and in the months ahead, the Wild Side News will continue to carry the dream that somehow, sometime, we may re-land our lifeboat and regain our paradise. And until we find a way to leave the barbarities of war and slaughter behind us, we'll all pay a very heavy price. But I do believe a day is coming when people will find peace on planet Earth. And I hope I'm alive to celebrate it. But until then, we carry on. And today, we're heading west where an amazing series of caves have recently been discovered. And then in segment two, we're off to Iowa to witness the emergence of a tropical rainforest. No, it's not a sudden outbreak of global warming. It's the culmination of years of effort to create an impressive enclosed natural environment known as Earth Park. But first, the news. A new report to be released by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change concludes that thinking about the effects of global warming over the next 100 years needs to be correlated with their projections, which suggest that the warming trends will continue for the next 1,000 years, whether we do anything or not. So we'd better be prepared to see a rise in our oceans of 11 to 17 inches in the next 100 years, with continuing rises thereafter. The report also indicates that the 20th century saw oceans rise 6.7 inches. In Washington this week, it hasn't gone unnoticed that President Bush acknowledged the existence of global warming and its human component. And yet at the same time, hearings this week by the newly elected Democratic Congress are revealing new allegations of political pressure by the White House on scientists to downplay the threat of global warming. 46% of federal scientists surveyed felt pressure to eliminate the words climate change and global warming from their communications. Henry Waxman, who chairs the committee, said his group is acting to prevent continued interference with science for political purposes. Friends of Yosemite National Park are squabbling about how best to love the park. One group fears that various development and use projects could seriously impact the Merced River and have succeeded in getting a federal judge to turn back plans for a $60 million development. Other friends of Yosemite fear that such objective constraints on park use, based on potential overuse or overdevelopment, could result in legal restrictions on use by humans, thus impacting the long-held tenet that national parks are for all people. And that's the news. Continuing with news of national parks, we now go to hear about a new discovery that has a lot of people talking. One of the grand places to visit is one of the legendary national parks in the American park system, Sequoia National Park in California, known for its extraordinary trees, legendary Sequoia trees. But there's another thing happening in Sequoia right now that I think a lot of people weren't that aware of, but it's making big-time news. And joining us now from Sequoia National Park is Joel Despain. Joel, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Well, now, you have a unique title for Sequoia National Park. Tell us what you do.
I'm the cave management specialist here at the National Parks.
And that would suggest that there's a reason for you to have that title. Sequoia has caves.
Indeed. In fact, we have actually about 240 caves known here at the two national parks. That includes the longest cave in California and a number of the other longest caves in the state.
So what does a cave manager do? Are you actively pursuing caves? You do cave research? What's involved in your day-to-day?
Yes, I think of what we do as really sort of having two components. One is protection and management. We put cave gates on sensitive caves. We issue permits for cave visits. We do restoration work in our commercial cave here at the park. And then the other half of what we do is cave research. We research the variety of resources that are found in caves, whether those are mineralogical, hydrological, animals, cave wildlife, lots of unique species. So those sorts of things are what keep us busy.
Part of that ongoing research is the quest for new caves, and apparently there are groups that assist you on an amateur basis. That is a lead into today's story. Describe what has happened in the last few months.
Late in August, a group of four cave volunteers for the park, affiliated with the Cave Research Foundation, did discover a significant new cave here in Sequoia and Kings Canyon. Now, we do find new caves fairly often, but most of the time they're 20, 30, 40, 50 feet long, pretty short, and aren't particularly compelling, don't really contain that many interesting features. This new cave, which has been called Ursa Minor, is quite different. It features very large rooms, large passageways, beautiful cave formations. We already know that there's a whole host of cave-adapted animals inside the cave. There are clearly significant animal remains inside the cave that might be of some age. And so we've really found a very significant new cave here in the two parks this time around.
I've done a little research on how the cave was discovered, and that's quite an interesting story all by itself.
The cave was found, well, by a group of people who were looking for caves. We have an ongoing park-approved research project here with the Cave Research Foundation folks. And they actually were doing small-scale excavations. They were digging in likely places where they thought they might be able to access the cave. And, of course, that requires some careful thought about the geology of the area, the hydrology of the area, and where a cave might be hidden. And even combined with that, though, they certainly got lucky to find such a significant and nice cave as Ursa Minor.
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I understand, the clue was an opening the size of a softball. Let's take it from there.
The opening was about softball size, and Scott McBride, a caver from the Central California, he had a flashlight along, and he could look through that hole and see back a ways, the number of feet. It was dark, and also that hole had a particular shape to it, one that really indicated the type of solutional erosion that is how cave passages form. And so he thought it looked good right off the bat, and then the cavers spent a number of hours, so three or so, they made one trip back to get some more equipment, and came back again for some more time to open up the cave and to allow access. And then immediately the entrance does go into a rappel, so they also had to get a rope and do that in order to enter the cave.
What was their first sense of the significance of this cave?
They were immediately excited and immediately realized that it was significant. As you go down the rope from the entrance that they opened up, you're in a nice cave passage, maybe 8 feet tall, 4 feet wide. It just is very pleasant, sort of, you know, body-sized passage or so. And then you suddenly go around a corner while you're still on rope, and you come out into the wall of a canyon that's 75 feet tall and 30 feet wide.
Wow.
And you can look off into blackness in one direction that's framed by these stalactites and other cave formations. So even on the rappel in, you realize that this is something quite significant.
I'd almost think you'd be afraid to enter in the sense that everywhere you step, there's wonder.
In a sense, there is. And these guys, I must say, did do a very good job on their first entry about being really careful about where they walked. You'll find that particularly these days, and particularly with newly discovered caves, that most people in the caving community are kind of aware of how they need to behave. Everyone walks in a single-file line. You don't just wander over to features. You look very carefully at where your feet are placed. You make big efforts to not transport or move sediments and dirt back and forth from areas that are muddy to areas that have nice sparkling cave formations. Now we've actually gone in and defined trails. We have routes we want people to follow through the cave that are more robust, and that will ensure that we do the absolute minimal damage and disturbance possible.
Well, with this kind of historical perspective on how the cave was discovered, now let's talk about what you have discovered. All reports are that it's a spectacular find.
It's a beautiful cave. It's just, it's very, the word I keep coming back to is aesthetic. It's just got beautiful shapes and forms. The rooms are large, which is unusual around here. A lot of our caves have many small, narrow, meandering passages. These are big, roomy spaces, and across all of these spaces, you just have sparkling floors that just glisten into your light. And hanging from the ceiling are long drapery and curtain-type formations that are very pretty. One of the rooms has a very large lake that sort of is divided into two lobes that's probably almost 100 feet across, and is just a beautiful blue, blue water down inside this lake. It is a seasonal lake. It's not completely full this time of the year. And other rooms have just beautiful displays of cave formations, beautiful pools, and wonderful things hanging from the ceiling. It's just a very pleasing, beautiful place.
Well, it's a large cave.
Large in terms of passage size. It's not a very long cave yet.
You've so far identified about 1,000 feet, but have you reached the end point yet?
We definitely have not. There are several places where cave passages continue, we can tell, and we've not chosen to follow those at this time, pending some good evaluation of what we already have, and we're trying to make sure we have everything well taken care of for what we've already seen before we go off into uncharted areas.
Give us a sense of the nature of the structure of the cave. I know that it has a series of rooms.
Yeah, it does have a series of rooms. They're essentially sort of two very large rooms sort of right off the bat, and from the first room down to sort of a lower right-hand side, there are some pits, some other rope drops. That area remains unexplored. To the left of that first room, there's a side passage that has many beautiful cave pearls in it. Then from the second room is the room that has the lake. From there, there are also a couple of side passages. One goes up to some upper back rooms that are very pretty, and another one goes to a climb, an area where the passage goes vertically, where we need to do some climbing to reach what is clearly an upper-level continuation.
Any evidence of existing animal life in the cave, which is always an exciting arena?
Yes. We also recently here at the National Parks completed an inventory of the wildlife living in park caves. And we actually were very surprised and pleased to realize that we had a whole series of new species, many of which were cave-adapted. And it appears that three of these new species of cave-adapted animals have been seen in this new cave. So we already know that the cave is significant in that it contains species that are endemic to the parks and to the cave systems of the parks.
Mm-hmm.
And very likely, with more research, we may very well find species that are unique to this cave. And that's a pretty common thing here, we've begun to realize, that a lot of our larger park caves do have their own unique species.
In terms of the animals that you find inside of a cave, they must enter from the outside, they would have to. Any idea of how long they've been there, or even sort of cross-pollination between caves of a similar species, which would indicate some sort of connection?
There are a lot of possibilities for how these animals have come to be adapted to the park caves and to be in the park caves. And, you know, sometimes you can look at the individual animal and figure some of these things out. For instance, some of the animals in park caves, these animals seem to be using caves as a refuge. These are animals that whose closest relatives are found to the north in climates that are currently cooler and wetter, and in that sense more similar to the way the climate has been here in the past. Caves are also a cooler and wetter climate, and so compared to the way things are here currently. And so the cave environment can be a natural refuge for animals that are adapted to a little bit different climate than we have here currently. But we also have animals here where we have a surface species, and then in a series of caves, each cave has its own unique species that's adapted inside the cave that's related to the surface species. So in other words, it's clear that the surface species that travel into these different caves, populations developed in those caves, and unique species grew out of each of those populations in each of those caves. So it can happen in a variety of ways that the evolutionary process takes place and these animals become either isolated unique species or unique species with relatives relatively close at hand.
Well, in terms of the species that you've found so far, give us an indication of what they are.
In the new cave, we have a Striuridae millipede, a lithobiomorph centipede, which is a predator, and then also potentially a Calcina harvestman, which is a sort of a, like a spider but with a single body instead of two that most spiders have, like a daddy long leg.
Mm-hmm. Now, in many cases, cave species are albino and blind. Is that the case here?
It is the case here. Albino isn't really quite the right term. You know, that's a specific genetic situation.
That's true.
In this case, the entire species has lost its pigmentation, lost their eyes, They have elongated appendages quite often. And they also actually tend to have a very different sort of lifestyle. They tend to have fewer young at a given time and to live quite a bit longer than their surface-dwelling relatives.
Hmm.
And those are all adaptations to a low-energy environment.
How many species have you identified or found,
actually,
let's say, discovered
total,
so far?
Mm-hmm. Total is 31.
Oh, that's
a lot. 31 new species of cave invertebrates we've found in the park caves in the past several years as the project's been going on.
There must be a sort of this incestuous feeding on each other. It's a closed environment.
Exactly, yes. And some of these animals are cannibalistic, so sometimes they'll even eat some of their own kind. And these are small communities. There's only a handful of species in each of these different caves. And so we are finding animals that are at all different parts of the food chain, and they definitely do prey upon each other.
Now, you also have a big lake, so have you had a chance to actually go underwater?
We have not. And that may be something we'll be doing in the future. The lake's pretty delicate. There's a lot of these cave formations lining its walls and bottom and things. But some diving in there may be appropriate in the future.
Well, of course, you could probably use some underwater viewing devices. I imagine.
Potentially so. Although we'd have to, anything like that, we'd have to take into the cave, which could be a little tricky.
Yeah. Well, let's talk also about this process of mapping. Of course, that's going to be a big part of this. What's involved? I mean, there's so many new technologies now. Probably things are really advancing nicely in that direction.
You know, we're still pretty much using 16th century technology, I hate to say.
My first thought was, well, this is going to be so much easier because of GPS, but probably GPS doesn't work under those situations.
It does not work underground because you can't really receive satellite signaling.
So you're back to ropes and other forms.
We use a tape, you know, a measuring tape, a compass, and a clinometer. And we make a series of straight line shots through the cave from point to point and record that data for each of those, and then that creates sort of a framework. And then from there, an individual with a lot of experience does a detailed drawing using standardized symbols from a legend to represent the cave's varied features. And you know, things like laser rangefinders are coming in big now, and they're already being quite helpful. In fact, we have used some of those on the survey at IRSA, and and probably one day we'll be able to enter all the data into a PDA and have it just beautifully plot the cave for us as we go. But we're just not quite there yet in terms of compact size, reasonable price, and robust enough electronics. But it's close.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these things are starting to be used in cave surveys now.
How long do you figure it's going to take you to survey this particular cave?
Well, to be honest, we're going slow right now. We've not quite surveyed everything that we've seen. We want to get that done. And I expect that will be completed this fall within the next month. Beyond that, it will just depend how long the cave is and how much more we find.
I'm curious. I'm a person who's intrigued with wonder and always liked that, the first new experience. What was it like for you personally as you entered this cave and suddenly realized you were in a place that perhaps, I don't know if you have any indication whether or not humans have ever been inside this cave, but perhaps no human has ever seen before?
We're pretty sure that there has not been anyone inside the cave before. There's still places where there are a lot of discoveries going on, you know. But for your average person to go somewhere where no one else has ever been, that's a rare thing. You know, unless you're an astronaut or a deep sea diver or something, that just doesn't happen every day.
Mm.
And it's really a big part of what caving is about and why caving, I think, is compelling to people, because you can go somewhere where no one has ever been, where you have no idea what you're going to find around the corner. And this cave was a big thrill in that way, because it was just immediately beautiful and big and compelling. The guys who had found it, you know, called me right away to tell me what they found, and these are experienced cavers. These guys, you know, they've been in a lot of caves, they've seen a lot of caves. And I could tell just from their excitement that this was something quite significant. And I went the next day.
Yeah.
I immediately wanted to see what it was they had seen and what had left them in such a pleased state.
As the cave manager, it's sort of, I can imagine it's almost like, okay, stand back, let me, this is my realm.
it's sort of like, I've got a job to do and I'm excited to do it.
That's great.
It was a real good day at the office, as I say with my assistant.
Yeah, for sure. So, as you go into this cave, give me some of your aha moments. What really caught your attention? Where did you say, oh my gosh, that is sensational?
Well, I think for me, definitely that first entrance rappel. Like I said, you go into the entrance, and it's a nice little cave passage. It seems, oh, this is great. And then you come around the corner on the rope, and it's like, holy cow. My jaw dropped when I looked off into the darkness from my perch up high on the wall into that 75-foot-tall passage going off into the mountain, I was just right off the bat there very, very taken aback and sort of realized why these guys were excited. Other things that struck me early on were the really beautiful floors. The calcite crystals that are found in the cave formations, found in the flowstones, are really large and particularly sparkly in this cave. And so the floors are just beautiful. The lake was also very exciting and just really impressive to see. Also the bones. And right there where you get off the rope as you come into the cave, there's a slope there where we also immediately found some of these cave-adapted animals. And so really just within the first half an hour, I was excited in a number of different ways and really feeling like we had a really significant find in our hands.
Now, did I hear you say bones?
Yes. There are clearly animals that have died in the cave, including one that's quite large. The name of the cave, Ursa Minor, to a certain extent, came from this because the animal resembles a bear.
Hmm.
We don't really know if it is a bear yet, and we'll have to, hopefully we'll have a paleontologist in there this fall to take a look at that for us.
Mm, that could be very interesting.
And there are bones in a number of other locations in the cave, too, that may very well be quite ancient.
Now, how is this going to affect our knowledge of cave formation? And why don't you give us a short version of how a cave like this is formed, and then how this may help advance the science?
Naturally, water under the ground is a little bit acidic. And this mostly comes from chemical processes in the soil. And acidic water, just a little bit acidic, I mean, less acidic than your glass of tea, actually has the ability to dissolve certain types of rock. And the most common type of rock people associate that with is limestone. And whenever you get limestone, you get sinkholes and springs and caves because of the way that water can erode this rock. Well, here in the Sierra Nevada, we have a little bit different version of the limestone. Here the rock is marble, which is beautiful rock. And it's also just the metamorphosed version of limestone. It's very much the same chemically as limestone. And so it erodes in the same way. Caves form by water moving underground, but that water is tied to surface streams. Caves end where springs form, while the water returns to the surface. Because of that, caves are closely tied to the landscape around them. And the elevation of a cave passage is determined by the landscape around them and by the elevation of the surface streams around them. So when you have an old cave, a big cave with multiple levels and such, that cave actually can give you a glimpse into geologic history. Here in the Sierra Nevada, the history of part caves actually can tell us a lot about the history of the mountain range. And part caves have been used to do this sort of work in the past, and Ursa Minor is going to be a great new place to do that sort of work.
Well, of course, now everybody wants to know, is the public ever going to see this cave in person?
You know, that's not really a question I can answer at all at this point. I mean, I think the cave is in a remote and isolated canyon. It does have a vertical entrance. I mean, there are a lot of challenges there. But really, you know, here at the National Parks, we've got a job, first of all, to figure out what we've got, to do a good inventory of the cave, to get good photographs of it, to understand the biology of it, to document its features. Once we know what we've got, then we'll go through a process of thinking about what's best for the cave and best for the park. You know, and that'll be a planning process and maybe part of an upcoming cave management plan for the parks. And, you know, through that whole process, we'll be talking to local people and anyone who's interested, people who are cave enthusiasts for sure. And from that point on, we'll be deciding a course of action long term. We won't make any snap decisions about what we're going to do with this cave. We'll go through a long process and let people comment and let them be involved.
How often are you able to actually head into this cave?
We're going, trips into the cave are only when there's a good purpose to go, and we try to get a lot done. Every entry into the cave could potentially cause some damage or disturbance that's not necessary. So we are going when we've typically got some of our cave volunteers around. There's just myself and one other person on our staff, and we're more efficient when we have more people. So when those folks are available and we've got a specific task at hand, then we'll go into the cave and do some more survey work, do some work on the trails, getting that well lined out, and things like that. The next big project will be week after next, and that's when we're going to put a gate on the cave.
Hmm.
We're actually going to go ahead and, at that time, we'll restore the entrance to that same size, that softball-sized hole that it was at originally, in order to keep the same airflow and climate and such inside the cave.
Interesting.
Then we'll make, you know, a removable component of the gate so that people can enter, but then the gate will be in place so that we can secure the cave.
Oh, very interesting. So you have to keep the climate the same.
Yep.
I suppose you've done some extensive monitoring on the humidity and temperatures and things of that nature.
We're just starting to do that at Ursa Minor. In fact, we've just been having a few little problems with that data logger. but we have done it for a number of other park caves, and we know that caves can often be very sensitive to climatic changes, and opening an entrance is one way to do that. Mm-hmm. You can dry things out is what would be our primary concern here.
Well, Joel, you're a lucky guy to be able to have access to such extraordinary wonder and be one of the first people to see such.
Well, thank you very much. I do like my job, and we certainly hope we very much do right by this cave.
Now, for people who want to follow this story, which will be emerging for the history of the National Park System onward and forward, what's the best way for them to find out more and follow the story?
You can check our park website, or to be honest, you can feel free to contact me at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park. Do you have specific questions or things you want to know about? I'm at joel_despain@nps.gov.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you, Joel.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to speak with you, too, and it was a pleasure.
The actions of this ancient earth provide us with almost unlimited wonder, which we find ways to celebrate in ever more extraordinary ways. In just a moment, we head east to Iowa, where citizens and governments have begun the construction of a life-size tropical rainforest. It's Earth Park, and it's coming up following this short break.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
These days, if someone starts talking about tropical rainforests in Iowa, many people will wonder just what this global warming thing is going to do to us. But it's not the direct effect of global warming that brings the tropics to the corn and the soybean fields. Precisely what is it that's bringing about this sudden change? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wildside News. If you were a farmer in the middle of Iowa, and you looked out over your frozen fields in the dead of winter and saw a gleaming tropical rainforest rising in the distance, you just might decide, now that's a great idea. Well, that's pretty much exactly what's happened, and we find out more of the details as we explore Earth Park. The movement towards creating a sustainable world is really catching on, and possibly no more right now this week than some news that's coming out of central Iowa about the ultimate environmental experience that I'm aware of in the United States. It's a very exciting new project called Earth Park. And I'm very delighted to have as our guest right now the executive director of Earth Park, David Ullman. David, welcome to the Wildside News.
Well, Sydney, thank you. It's fun to be with you and look forward to your questions and talking about this exciting project we have here in the U.S.
Let's first of all give our listeners a concept of what it is that Earth Park hopes to be.
Well, Earth Park is aimed at a pretty lofty goal, and that is at being an environmental center for the United States. We don't have a project that really has that specific of a mission. Our board mission statement is inspiring generations to learn from the natural world. How do we do that? In person at a very large, complex center that will include about 3.5 to 4 acre enclosed rainforest biome with connections to environmental hotspots globally. Anchored in learning with a lot of engaging kiosks, exhibits, and galleries for learners of all ages, and virtually with a very robust internet presence similar to what you do, hopefully, as good as what you do. But we want to be able to use the information, the connections, some of the curricula that our educators have beginning to come up with, and share that with people all over, regardless of whether or not they're ever able to come to the Midwest and see our project.
This is in Iowa. And of course, I think there's a number of people who are going to say, why Iowa?
Well, that's a fair question. Iowa is certainly not the largest state in our country, but it's a state that celebrates two great values that we have for well over 100 years. This is a state that is a leader in our country in education. Our students always test number one or number two. We're a very literate state. We're also well-traveled. Iowans have the distinction of being a pupil with the highest percentage who have passports, so we like to go elsewhere and see other people's dreams. But we're also centrally located near the intersection of two of our country's busiest interstates, 80 east-west and Interstate 35 north-south. We're going to build this project on a large 15,000-plus acre lake, the largest body of water between the Ozarks and Lake Mille Lacs up in northern Minnesota, where you're from. And we're a place that not only is grounded in education, but I'll finish the thought, it's also a place where we're grounded in conservation. We take environmental stewardship quite seriously. And I attribute a lot of that to our agricultural heritage and the fact that we pay attention to soil and water quality. So for all those reasons, plus the fact that our benefactor and our board and our former governor and others who have worked on this project all live here, that's why the project will be built in the state of Iowa.
This follows on a successful project in England that kind of defined the possibilities for a very large-scale environmental learning center. Why don't you talk about the Eden Project?
Well, I'm happy to do that, too. We've become, on a personal basis, well acquainted with and friends of the team that planned and brought forth the Eden Project in Cornwall 5 years ago. They're great people. They're tenacious Brits. They're good marketers, but they're also grounded in education. And they, too, have a story of celebrating the environment. And I would encourage people to look at that project's website, Eden, E-D-E-N, as in the Garden of Eden, EdenProject.com. And on that, they'll find a wealth of information. Eden is in Cornwall. It's about 5 hours west of London on the isthmus or tip of England that juts out to the Atlantic. It's not easily a place you could get to, but it's well worth the effort. And they've created this spectacularly large biome, about 150 feet tall, big trees, thousands of various plant species, and you are in there, you feel the humidity and the heat, you feel like you're in a real living, breathing rainforest. And about a year ago, they added on an educational center called The Core. Here's what's most impressive, I believe, in addition to the content. In 5 years, they have seen 8 million visitors come to Eden, people from all over the continent, some from the U.S., after your experience, you come away with a whole new appreciation for plants, for nature, for the stewardship that we need to provide. And it celebrates what people can do and the difference that we can make. And they are a team that has given us a lot of good information. We share the same architect, the Grimshaw firm out of London, New York. And they are eager for us to become their U.S. counterpart, and we certainly are looking forward to doing that.
From what I understand, this is going to be a total immersion experience. We're going to talk about the enclosure itself. This is a destination point. You can literally come here and spend time. There's going to be places to stay and a larger landscape. Talk about what the totality of this experience will include.
That's a really good question, and I appreciate you asking that. We are aiming the project at being something that could be a wonderful resource for people, whether they be casual visitors or more purposeful in doing ecotourism and trying to come someplace in the upper Midwest and really learn, whether they're spending half a day or a day or 3 days with the scientists and with the master teachers on site. We will build, again, about a 3.5 to 4 acre biome covered with a Teflon-like material from a German firm called Foiltech. Very interesting design, very iconic, different kind of building, powered by an array of alternative renewable energy sources. We hope, indeed, that the building itself will teach about efficient design and construction. The overall site that we'll be sitting on is a beautiful wooded tract, mature trees, and it will be next to this large, very large body of water. There will be some green hotels. There'll be nearby a wonderful small community and a lot of other visitor amenities that people will be able to take in. In addition to spending time, there'll be a couple hotels, a water park for kids. So it'll be a fun overall experience. We hope people will want to spend 2 or 3 or 4 days on site.
There's every reason to have fun and learn at the same time.
You know, thank you for saying that, too, because learning and fun are not mutually exclusive. In fact, most of the surveys will tell you that there's better retention, better memory when experiential learning is fun. And a lot of science centers, museums, botanical facilities, and others are also aware of that and are trying to freshen up the experience. We certainly want to launch with something that has a great, colorful variety of plant life, some animals, reptiles. We'll have about a 600,000-gallon aquarium, fresh water, recreating the flooded rainforest. And it's all about giving people a variety of exciting experiences. We're also going to load in some high technology and some virtual reality experiences that can put people literally in other places around the planet. We think a lot of people, particularly young ones, will just find a lot of excitement in that.
Most nature centers cater towards schools and family visits, but this really is going to be a family experience. That's a different sort of way to approach environmental learning on a family basis. It's a form of localized ecotourism.
Well, it clearly is. And, again, we honor what's gone before, but our architects, Grimshaw, Sir Grimshaw, and others have been very clear to us that we want to respect our visitor, our learners, plural, and not dumb it down. We do want people to have fun, but we don't want to just have a little plaque that they read as they go by on a linear route. We want to have a lot of interactive learning. Again, some kiosks and some opportunities for people to make inquiry-based learning possible, and they can spend as much or little time as they want. The architects are working to come up with multiple routes through the biome, so you don't just start at point A and end at point B, troll along following somebody right in front of you, but we'll be able to cross-cut between the cloud forest, recreated jungle, and also the flooded Amazon waters experience, and move in and out from a learning core that will have information in it. So it's all aimed at what's known as free choice learning. Give people the right to do what they want to do. And again, if we're smart about it, we have a lot of work to do to map it all, but if we can robustly use the internet, encourage people to be online with us before and after their experience, you can sort of extend the learning moment. People can be a little better prepped when they come and then hopefully have a great time and go home and can stay in touch with Earth Park. And their website will be earthpark.org. We should get that out there. And there are already some interesting information up on the net, more to come. But if we do it well and link to other good facilities like what you've talked about, we can have a real impact for learners all over and help propel interest in the environment and in sustainable living.
You've got one of the greatest jobs in the world right now, and that is to dream about what is possible in terms of environmental learning. And you get to start from the ground up here, find the best, and then put it inside. So give us, at this point, I'm sure you have some really terrific visions of what that experience will be like. Give us some highlights.
Well, we're blessed to have good people on this team. Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa helped a few years ago with funding to put together an education design team. And we got some of the smart people in the ranks of education, formal education, K-12, public and private, and also higher ed, not only from Iowa but from around the country, to dream, to do some charrettes and think about content and design and come up with what we could do. And more recently, Senator Grassley from Iowa has helped with some assistance from the Department of Energy as well. They're very interested in, again, the alternative and renewable energy technology sources that could be applied to fuel the building, to run it, and the life support systems on the inside. Back on the learning front, we hope to, as I said, have learners of all ages. Probably see about 100,000 young people through on an annual basis. That's quite a bit, actually. We're learning from, again, what they're doing at the Eaton Center in the UK. One of the things, Sydney, that I think really is exciting is that there's some specific thinking oriented to teachers. If we lose a lot of teachers in society, with people who go to school, get an education major, teach for 3 to 5 years, and check out because of relatively low pay or discipline issues, whatever, classroom. We unfortunately lose a lot of our best teachers at a relatively young age. The thought here would be that if we could create a really exciting 21st century environmentally themed learning center where these young teachers could come maybe 5 years into their career, recharge their battery, hang with other teachers, work with master teachers, and rejuvenate themselves and remind themselves of why they get into teaching in the first place, and then send them out armed with great new information, context. Maybe we keep some in the profession, particularly in science and in environmental science, as the demand for more information on those fronts grows. We think if we just could do that, in addition to obviously building, opening, and running this well, we would have made a great contribution.
Nothing works better for teachers than to get into a situation like that where suddenly their eyes are open to all sorts of new opportunities. I know I've been through that many times myself. And you think you got a pretty good handle on something, and then someone says, here, why don't you try this? Why don't you try mapping the area? And just all sorts of different techniques that bring excitement to learning. And that's critical for a successful learning back in the classroom. That's a great great tie-in.
Well, it all starts with good teaching. And we're fortunate in this country. Anyway, we have thousands of great teachers. Unfortunately, as the boomers age, you and I among them, in the decade of the teens, we're going to lose some of the very best teachers in this country. We've got to recruit a new core of people and then keep them in the profession and keep them excited about teaching for decades to come. You're absolutely right. The environment is only going to become more important. More information, as it's threatened, will be out there. And if we can't be a place that helps enable the transfer of information, give people those kinds of touch points, then, again, we'll be helping. And we want to learn from a lot of others, and we're getting a lot of good suggestions, good ideas from people all the time, and we're grateful for those.
This will be a recreation of a rainforest environment, so that when you walk in from, it's a 20 below zero outside on a February, and you walk in, that's going to be kind of nice all by itself.
Well,
paradise in Iowa. That's interesting.
It may be 20 below, the Canadian border, but we rarely get that cold here. We may have a handful of days at zero or slightly below zero. But the wintertime at Eden, again in the UK, they do very well over there for that very reason. People like the respite.
Oh yeah.
I can just it'll be fun all four of our distinct seasons, we believe.
Having lived in Minnesota, I can just imagine these people in the parkas and the snow boots coming in and ripping them off.
Yeah.
And just wanting to be there for relaxation.
Well, let me build a big coat room, won't we?
You're going to have a huge coat room. It'll actually be a parka room. Yeah.
Right.
Now, you're going to have a 600,000-gallon aquarium. Configure that for me so that the people have a picture of that in their mind.
We don't expect to look like a shed aquarium, if I could use that as an example, or more recently, the spectacular new aquarium in Atlanta, Georgia, which is about close to 5 million gallons, gargantuan in size. We will not just have tanks. There may be some of those. But mostly what we want to do is mimic what happens in the real rainforest with the incredible amount of rain that they get in the rainforest. You see the rise and fall of the water table down there. In some parts of the rainforest, they get 400 inches of rain. And we took some from our science and design team to Brazil just last January, about 9 months ago. detail the story of the flooded rainforest, the story of water in that ecosystem is integral. That's why it's called the rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can capture a slice of that and tell that in a compelling way, it will be fun. And so it'll be, it won't be your classic aquarium where you'll just be staring at a 12-foot-high tank, but it will be integrated with the trees. There will be fish, some reptiles, and amphibians around. And it should be a fun experience.
Now, are you also going to have mammals free-roaming and that type of thing?
Well, it's under consideration. There are some who are championing that. If you want to have a true ecosystem, obviously that would be part of it. There are cost issues involved there, and visitor issues that need to be taken into account, setbacks, and not only for the safety of our guests, but also for the safety of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we'll see that in a limited way. Certainly we'll see a lot of very colorful birds, but I don't know that we'll see a lot of animals. At the Eden Project, you see zero. They have birds in there, but they don't really have any other species.
Also, virtual reality, this is something I've always been fascinated by. I've always had a dream of doing a traveling tour where a person could go into a room and dial in an environment anywhere in the world and do, you know, surround visuals, sounds, and a sense of even humidity and different things. What's your dream for? I realize a lot of this, by the way, is in the planning stages, and you're very lucky. And I don't want to have you. Nothing that we're saying here is set in concrete, okay? Because you're in a planning stage here. But you know, what kind of vision are you looking at for your virtual reality chamber? A cell, a theater, an auditorium? What are you looking at there?
Well, we'd like to go north of what we see today, which is the IMAX experience. And those are terrific. We'd like to use a real digital format. We'd like to surround people. We'd like to have it be a little more intimate. We've got good people at Iowa State University up in Ames, where there's been some real excellent work for the last several years on virtual reality depictions, and others who are giving us good counsel. You said it well. Well, a lot of that's still under investigation. There are budget implications, to be sure. I'd say over the next year, a lot of that will be thought through much more than it is today. But
mm-hmm.
we've raised the bar on ourselves to see if we can't create an experience like that in addition to what we have in the biome.
You've got some great partners who've helped launch this. I believe you're going to start groundbreaking in 2007. So give us a sense of who some of the principals are that have really helped to make this happen. You've already mentioned some. And then also, what are we looking forward to in terms of a timeline?
Well, good. We do have good partners, and you discover quickly when you work on something like this with a big vision, and then your team is charged with delivering that you... You've got to get a lot of help. Partnering counts for quite a bit, public sector and private. On the public side, again, good help from a number of educational institutions and individuals. The U.S. Department of Energy has been good. We are working with some firms in corporate America, many of which are excited about sustainability and retooling their own companies to be more environmentally responsible, and understanding also where the market is going, that people expect that from those that they do business with. We've, in the last few months, we've signed up the Siemens Corporation, the German company, as our technology partner. We've had multiple meetings with them. More recently, two team meetings where each site had six or seven people around the table mapping out the energy systems for the project. And so Siemens is a great firm. Long heritage over on the continent, not as well known in the U.S., but very good people committed to responsible environmental action, and we're elated that they're on this team. There are other companies with whom we're talking as well, and I hope soon to be able to share their names with you as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, groundbreaking 2007, and how long do you expect
about
this?
Yes, you asked about the timetable, and I hopped over that. The groundbreak will be, we hope, roughly mid-year next year. And it's about a two-and-a-half to three-year build and some time to populate the biome. So we're looking at, best case, probably mid-2010 as an opening. And we hope some pre-opening opportunities. And if I could not unduly talk about Eden, but again, I think it's helpful to do that because if people can understand what goes on at Eden, they'll have a better sense of what we are going to do. They opened up that project early. summer of 2000 before it was completed. And they actually had people pay about £5, which at the time was about $8, to tour what in effect was a construction site.
That would be fun.
It was fun. And it taught people what was coming. It showed them the scale of the project. And it invested them in the story and got them emotionally involved. So guess what? When they cut the ribbon and opened the doors, they all came back.
Oh, I'd be there any number of times.
Again, they've taught us well. And if we can generate that kind of interest here in the U.S., in the heartland, and again, with the Internet programs like yours, we can be talking to people in Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon. And we really do believe that once this is open, people will find their way here. We've actually had some people in corporate America tell us that they're glad that we are in the heartland, that we're in the Midwest, that we're not on either coast, so that people can get here. And we're not jammed into a dense urban setting. We've got elbow room. We've got quiet. We've got beauty. We've got this incredible body of water. Very placid, bucolic, special place, and a place to grow over time, too, in the years ahead.
People used to head to the cities to have a great time because there was a lot going on in the cities. Now the cities have become a bit challenging. It's hard to find a place to park. It's noisy. It's busy. Traffic is stuck. So guess what? People are heading out to the country.
You're exactly right. I think for our story, for what we're trying to share with people, it works best for us to be outside of that kind of congested space and in a place where people can look up and see the stars and look out and see the great sunsets and then go inside in this biome and take up, wander and be full of wonder, and I think we've got a great location in Pella, Iowa.
Now, tell me where that is. I want to know where that is so I can say in 2010 I'm going to plan a visit to Pella, Iowa.
Pella is a beautiful community of about 11,000 people. It's about 40 minutes southeast of Des Moines, which is the state capital of Iowa, and it's where Interstate 80 and Interstate 35 intersect. So we're just 40 minutes from that intersection, less actually from Interstate 80, due south of Interstate 80. It's a town with a proud Dutch heritage, a lot of windmills, and we're really having a lot of fun as we look at the possibility of using wind energy on site or maybe connected to some of the big wind farms in north central northwest Iowa. They've got these restored 19th century windmills. We may drop a couple of 21st century wind turbines right there next to the lake. That just adds a little irony to everything, but we couldn't have a better community. Wonderful people, very entrepreneurial, real excited about sustainability, and they're just great hosts. That site is only about a week and a half old. We just picked it. We had 16 communities in our state that at one time or another expressed some interest in hosting the project. We had a very deliberate site process that took us to 12 and 7 and 4 and finally to this one.
Well, I'm excited about being able to announce Pella as the site for the new Earth Park that is going to start groundbreaking in 2007 and take 3 years or so to put together, 2010. Great to know about this happening right now. It's an exciting opportunity. You and I will keep in touch, and we'll let the world know about Earth Park. David Ullman, the executive director of the Emerging Earth Park. One more time, where can people go to find out information about Earth Park?
First, Sydney, my thanks again to you for your interest and for the time in talking today and giving us the opportunity to share with people, your friends, people who care about these matters. Earthpark.org is the domain, and we would welcome people looking into that. They can find quite a bit of information about the plans for Earth Park, what will be inside and outside. We invite you and them to stay in touch with us as we go about the next few years of planning, designing, and building. That's going to be a very special time. And then once open, we'd love to see people come on here.
Well, David Ullman, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
You're welcome.
As we float off into the sunset in this, our little Earth boat, let us keep our eyes wide for safe landing. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.